serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Don Malik. He lives in Lancaster, California, not far from Edwards Air Force Base, where for years he was on the cutting edge of aviation advances. He'd been a Navy fighter pilot, gone back to school to earn an aeronautical engineering degree from the University of Florida. He'd flown for NASA's predecessor, the NACA, in Langley, Virginia, before heading to Edwards in 1963. By that time, Don was married with four children, but unfazed by the inherent danger of doing things in the sky that no one had ever done before.
I like the idea of the flight tests, sort of looking in the unknown or proving things or discovering things, and it just seemed like it was a high interest to me. And to go out and take a flight test card out, like on a Blackbird, and do a really good flight and complete all those points and get that data, that was very meaningful. And if you went out and you had some problem, either with the airplane or with you, with the way the tests weren't, you come back okay, you say, well, that happens, that's okay. But you always look forward to the performance. That seemed like a challenge to me.
But you also knew how dangerous it was. And you got a wife, and then you end up with four kids, and you're still doing this stuff. I mean, how do you balance that ever-present danger?
I think early in a career, I'll go back to flight training and tell you about down in Cabinets, Texas, where we're flying the Hellcats, learned to fly the Hellcats. We lost five cadets in about 5 weeks out of that training command. Now, two of them were mid-airs, where they lost two airplanes and cadets at once. I didn't know any of those fellas personally. They were in other training squadrons around, the same base and everything, but none were close to me. And what really gets to a person when they're a friend or somebody close to you, you know them, you appreciate them, you miss them. Whereas somebody down the hall or somebody you don't know or haven't met or anything, he's sort of a number and you're sorry he's gone, but that happens. So you sort of develop an iron curtain or a feeling in yourself where you say, hey, it's part of the business. I'm aware of that. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to be too smart for it to happen. And a lot of times they're pretty smart guys that get killed. But you have to have that approach to it. You can't worry about it or think about it or let it bother you.
You say, it wouldn't happen to me. I was too good. I was too smart. And then you said, there are a lot of smart guys who got killed.
That's right.
And in your book, you talk about some of these guys. And it seems like every time this happens, you're stunned that it happened to him because he was so talented and so skilled.
Yeah, that's right.
How often do you think about those guys?
Well, I think about them now. And I walk in the garage. I've got pictures on the wall of them and everything. But I don't let it beat me down or anything. I just think about, well, I had a great experience with those fellows. I worked with them for a period of time, and they were lost and gone. And it's hurtful, but I try not to let it influence the way I carry out the rest of the day.
When you think back about those test flights, are there a moment or two that you found most exhilarating or exciting? And are there some aspects of your time as a test pilot that you look back on now and say, that's what I'm most proud of?
The LLRV was the biggest national known program that I flew on because we're getting it ready for the moon mission. Bell built the thing and they shipped it out here in parts. Bell Aircraft wanted to test it. And a lot of times the companies test the vehicle before they turn it over to NASA or the Air Force. But Bell wanted to test it, but they had an exorbitant fee, real high fee for their test pilot to fly it. NASA said, bring it out to Edwards. We'll put it together and we'll fly it here. And so we did. So
you guys had to put it together.
Yeah, they assembled it out at NASA, all the parts.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about, tell them what LLRV stands for.
Well, it's a pipe-built contraption, a lunar lander research vehicle, and it was built initially to evaluate the control powers and the control damping that the people landing on the moon would require to make a safe landing on the moon. We were trying to determine that down here. So this machine was designed to fly like it was in a lunar environment, and that was sort of a unique thing that was done through computers. And it had a jet engine in the middle that would support 5/6 of its weight, and had rocket engines that would support the other 1/6, which gave it the lunar gravity simulation. So we would set it up, the jet engine was partially holding it, and we were flying it on the rocket engines and evaluating the attitude controls and difficulty in landing. And we were setting limits, and limits were important because if we called for too much thrust, that meant they had to carry more fuel aboard to the moon, and that was always a problem. Every pound a vehicle went on was important, so that was an initial test that we're doing on it. So to start off with, first of all, we had to develop the computer systems and verify that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. That was initial proof, and then we went into the evaluation of flight control systems and damping. And as we finished up the program, Joe Walker and myself, Jack Kluver came in, an Army helicopter pilot, was signed to NASA, and we checked out Jack, and then Walker was moving over to the B-70. The Houston pilots were coming up, two pilots were coming up. They were going to be instructor pilots for the astronauts because they were going to ship those down to Houston. Plus, they bought a couple more from Bell, and they called the later ones the LLTV. Training vehicle, whereas ours was RV, research vehicle. But it was a pretty demanding type program, and it was an important program, and it went pretty well. We were fortunate out here. We didn't have any accidents. Down at Houston, they had two ejections. They lost two vehicles. Pilots made it safe. Neil Armstrong fell at land on the moon, ejected down there. And it was just a fact, in a training environment, it was still a very tricky thing to fly. And had to be very careful, limitations and everything in it. But anyway, when the boys come back from the moon, somebody asked me, well, what do you think about that thing helping them on the moon? I said, I can't comment till they come back. But every one of them come back said, we're glad we had the LLTV training on Earth for the moon landing. And all of the moon landings, the final landing was manual. Pilots were flying it like we did here. It wasn't automatic. I think the approach to it was pretty much automatic, coming out of the orbit of the moon and getting into the vertical, but the actual maneuver and landing was manual on them. So I think that was, you know, a big contribution to the lunar mission. And I was proud of that I was involved with it, but I was also proud of the 9 years I flew the Blackbird and some of the tests we did on it, too. So.
Well, that had to get your adrenaline pumping a little bit with the Blackbird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a...
What does it feel like when you're going 2,200 miles an hour?
Well, the only feeling you have inside the cockpit is that things are happening quicker as far as getting set up and established for doing test points and changing systems and positions and everything. You're very busy.
Were there any lessons that you and Joe Walker, who would go on to be killed in a midair collision in a B-70, were there any lessons that you guys learned the hard way that those astronauts in their training didn't have to learn because you already had?
I'm sure there were, just in basic developing the system. There were things that we had to correct and change on the system before it was presented to them. I think their checkout, Major Kluver was a big one there, checking out their two instructor pilots. That was a big transition of knowledge over to them. You know, you pass that on to the new guys that are going to fly it, and that was important. I don't think there's any super secrets that we discovered that if you did this, it was easy or something like that. It was just a task, and you did it. And the techniques that we developed and everything, I think, went over to them flying it, but I'm not sure if they were all used on the moon landing other than maybe the basic maneuvering qualities of the thing and the vertical control and touchdowns and thing.
Well, and just even those things, which seem intuitive, were so new for you guys. You mentioned you'd spent a little time in helicopters and you've been flying jets, but you get this lunar lander, and I mean, there's nothing like it that's ever really been built, right? It's brand new. It's one of a kind.
Well, they've had some vertical takeoff machines, but none quite like the lunar lander. None where they had the computer and where they had the lunar environment where they had reduced the thrust. That thing even had a cancellation of air drag. It didn't have that much drag, but when you're moving through the air, the engine would tip forward and cancel the drag. So it was just like you're flying in a vacuum, like on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And all the attitude control. So it really had some unique features that were never flown before. Yeah, vertical.
And I'm just thinking, when you mentioned that Bell had you guys put it together,
yeah,
I'm thinking of all those kids in the 70s and 80s that bought a little plastic model of the lunar lander and put it together in their playroom. And you guys were doing the full-scale model before any of that ever happened. And I think you had some moments while piloting that craft where it almost got away from you.
I had one approach, and it was pretty close, a spooky one. And what it was pilot error on my part. On this ejection seat, you had your own seat cushion because it was pretty critical on the ejection that the rocket thruster had to go up through your body CG. So as it carried you away from the vehicle, you didn't rotate and get tangled on your parachutes. Well, they made some calculations on it. Weber Aircraft, after mine had been issued about halfway through the program, and they said, we want you to use a different seat cushion. It was a little bit higher. And so they did. They put it in. It was probably only that much higher. But anyway, as I sat in the seat and I was flying it and I had my hand on this one collective, my thumb, it was a little bit further up in the collective, which didn't seem to bother me, but there was a trim switch on there. I apparently had got my thumb on that thing and I got a transfer of fuel into the LLRV where it was out of balance. When I flared and I was using a minimum control speed, we were evaluating the very low powered rockets, which was dicey there. But when I flared into a hover, it started to roll off and I had full stick. Well, what I did then, I jumped on a switch that went to both attitude controls because I needed more attitude, and that snapped me back the other way too far, and I went through this PIO type thing, finally getting it settled out, and I landed. Well, when we went back through, I didn't know what had happened even then. I thought, well, they checked the balance, and they said, Don, that one peroxide tank you were trimming from the other side, and it was one of those things, the system was put in if you needed it, and we never did need it on the thing. The missions and everything were only a minute, minute and a half in the lunar simulation, and it wasn't a need, the transfer was even. But that switch was still there, and I had to justify to myself, why in the world did I do that switch after flying it this long? And I thought, aha, that damn seat cushion put me a little bit further forward where I naturally reached out. My hand was a little bit higher in the collector. So I'll tell you what they did do. They put a big spring in the switch anyway, a bigger spring.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't do that again. But that was spooky because that was real close to the ground, and I had run out of attitude control, and the next thing I knew was going to be landing sideways. But when I got that both controls and the new rockets in, powerful rockets, it brought it right back up, attitude. That's something we've passed on to the astronauts. They didn't have to do that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If they hadn't changed that spring, maybe those guys would have come in sideways on the moon.
Might have been.
Let's run through some of the things you did. You chased rockets to evaluate their performance?
Well, that was at Langley, yeah.
You did sonic boom tests?
Well, on the sonic boom tests over at Langley, that was early. First, I think it's the first flight program that was really done. They were interested in overpressures because there were reports around the country where people were getting broken windows and things like that from the military airplanes and all. But anyway, Langley got a program, and they went up to Chincoteague, Maryland, which is near Salisbury, and they put a big line of microphones from inland right out Chincoteague on the coast, right out to sea on boats. They had all these microphones, and they laid out a test range down to Virginia Beach, and NASA procured a couple of F-8U-3s that were in competition with the F-4 and the F-4-1 competition, and the F-8U-3s were available. Military didn't want them. NASA wanted them because they go fast, go high. So another fellow, Bill Alford, and myself flew that program, that sonic boom program, and we would turn out around Virginia Beach and make our acceleration. And go up to, I think we're tops, we're running 60,000 feet at Mach 2 through the gate, what they called it, and that's when we crossed all this measurement on the ground.
And what was the end result of those tests? Did then they set a limit for the speed?
What they did was they measured the overpressure at various altitudes, so it gave them a feel for maybe what would be breaking windows and things like this, as far as the altitude and the Mach numbers. Then shortly after that, it wasn't too long after that, that the military quit flying supersonic over the country.
Well, anything else that you want to speak to, I want to give you the chance, but I realize there's probably one name that I haven't asked you about, that when people hear Edwards Air Force Base and flight tests, the name Chuck Yeager might be the first one off their tongue. And you actually trained under Chuck for a while, right?
Well, what happened when I first reported out here in 63, I was here not quite a year, and Joe Walker walked in one day, a chief pilot at NASA. He said, hey, how'd you like to go to the test pilot school? I said, I'd like to. You got any money? Because it was very expensive for civilians and other types to go through. He said, yeah, headquarters is approved too, you and Fred Hayes. Fred was new too with me there at Edwards. He'd come out from Cleveland. And so we were able to go through the test pilot school, which was really a break to have that because I didn't have it. I was trained at Langley with the old senior test pilots and getting into programs, learning in job training type thing. Well, the test pilot school was very formal and very broad, and it was excellent school. And somebody asked me one time, well, how long do you think you'd have had to fly to get that experience. I said, well, in a lot of test operations, maybe not NASA so much, but with companies and things, you'd have had to probably go at least 3 years to come out with the same experience that you come out of a test pilot school out of 6 months or a year. So it was very concentrated, a good school. Yeager was commandant. Just before I went to the school, Fred and I went over, I was towing, I was flying a C-47, towing a lightweight lifting body, the shape. I had flown the lifting body on the lake bed behind the Pontiac. We had a tow car that would get it up in the air about 40, 50 feet, and then you cut the line and make a landing. And so I'd gone through that, and it was about my time to fly it, but it was time to go to school. Well, Yeager knew the head of NASA at that time very well, Bickel. He had worked for the Air Force for a while before he came to NASA. Mm-hmm. And Yeager conned to ride in the lifting body, but they were good enough to give me my flights too. And I was in class, we were all working the mathematics and everything. Well, Yeager sticks his head in the door. He said, hey, Malik, come on, we're going to NASA. And I thought, what the hell do I do now? So I went with him, went over to NASA, and we were flying the lifting body. We both got a couple of flights in it. So when I got back to the class with my classmates, they said, where'd you go? What'd you do? I said, oh, I went over and flew the lifting body. They said, what the hell are you doing in this school? I said, same thing you are, learning all the basics here.
And another thing I guess I have to ask you, and I can tell it's not something you think about a lot, but you talk about Joe Walker, who I know you learned a lot from, you had great respect for, and he died as a test pilot.
Yeah.
He talked about Bill Alford, and you guys did the sonic boom test together, and he died as a test
pilot.
He
died, yeah. Bill did, yeah.
But you're still here. How do you explain it?
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder myself. I walk in out of my garage, and I look at all the pictures, and all those guys are dead, and I think, what the hell am I doing still here? I guess luck of the draw or whatever, but I know there are a lot of good people that were killed. It wasn't their fault. Things happened and it went. And I've had a few close ones and calls and everything, but I was fortunate to get away with them.
You mentioned you've flown 125 different aircraft. Is there anything you haven't flown in that you would like to?
Well, I think the most satisfying program for me was the Blackbirds. I flew those 9 years. I did go out 5 years after I retired. They invited me out, and I flew an F-18, two-place F-18. And that was sort of a gift from NASA and the director out there at that time. I had gone through all the ground school just before I retired, and he didn't get the airplanes ready.
Mm.
And it took them a while to get some good F-18s in from the Blue Angels and get them refurbished. And so I got to go out and fly that one. That was lots of fun. But when I look at some of the airplanes now, like the F-35s and the Super Hornets and things like that, I think, oh, that'd be nice to be able to fly something like that. But I flew something that was just like that in my day. That's today's day, and I'm not flying today.
Fair enough.
It's not my turn.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something you'd say? Because I think most of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about test pilot programs and what's being developed and the people who have to carry out that dangerous duty. Is there something you'd like the rest of us to know or understand or remember about guys like you who risked your lives to advance technology the way you did?
No, I think they're just, you know, like race car drivers in their career, they go out and those guys are piling up and metal and bending metal and doing things and all sorts of things going on in the world today that aren't too unlike it, risk-wise things. We always had the feeling that we were technically superior. We had looked at everything and did everything. Now it was time to go out and look at a few unknowns and do that, and we'd do that. And that was part of the game. Sometimes they'd bite you, and sometimes they wouldn't.
And as you might imagine, Don has many more stories that would not fit into our radio time today. So many memories from an extraordinary aviation career. You can hear more of those in the extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. And of course, you can read all about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene. Check it out. I want to make sure to thank a loyal listener and submarine veteran named Jason Head for cluing us into Don and his unique story. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time. I don't think we're going to be talking about 80,000 feet, 2,200 miles an hour, or the mission to the moon, but no doubt we will be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.